Welcome to Women in Translation, a series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more.
In this episode, host Jordan Rouleau speaks with French author and children's writer Agnès Desarthe and her translator, Christiana Hills, about Agnès's novel, Hunting Party.
Welcome to Traffica Europe Radio's Women in Translation series. I'm your host, Jordan Rouleau, and I'm joined here today with French author and translator Agnès Desarthe and translator Christiana Hills to discuss Agnès's novel, Hunting Party, translated from French by Christiana. Agnès Desarthe has been working as a translator from English for over 30 years. As a writer, she writes both for children and the rest of the world. She has translated the works of Morris Sendak, Virginia Woolf, Cynthia Ojick, Lois Lowry, Jay McInerney, John Steinbeck, and Philip Sands, among many others. She's published over 40 children's books and nearly 15 novels, biographies, and nonfiction for adults. She's written several scripts, plays, many songs, poems, and short stories. She lives in Normandy, not far from the sea, with her husband and two of their four children. She loves to cook, play the flute, and sing, and was lucky enough to record an album with the great jazz pianist René Utriger a few years ago. Christiana Hills has been working as a literary translator from French for over 10 years. She has a penchant for playful experimental works, such as Oulipo member Michel Audin's novel 121 Days and children's audiobooks for Editions Luni. Originally from Michigan, she now lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, with her husband and two young daughters. Welcome, Agnès and Christiana. It's really great to have you here.
Hello, Jordan.
Hello.
Yeah, so Agnès, could you maybe start us off by giving listeners a brief summary of the novel?
Oh, summaries. Summaries are so difficult. I'll try. Let's start with the main character, Tristan. When the book starts, he has just recently moved to a village with his young wife. And he's pretty young himself. And because they are worried that they are not going to get to know other people in the village, because they come from the city, the wife, Emma, has the idea that he should go hunting with the men. And so that's how the book starts. Not exactly how it starts, but that it's the starting point. He has to go hunting, and he's never hunted before. And he's going by accident to shoot a rabbit. And it's a bit difficult to explain, but the rabbit and Tristan are going to strike a kind of friendship. So this is the one part of the novel. And then there's another part, because at one point there's an accident with a river overflowing and there's a flood in the village during this hunting party. And so the book develops in two sections. There's on the one hand the hunting party itself with Tristan and the man from the village. And on the other hand, all of Tristan's memory of his life before he came to the village. I hope it's not too confusing for you, but a summary is always a difficult exercise.
Yeah, I know summaries are definitely very difficult to accomplish, but I think you did a great job painting a picture there. Yeah, but it would also be really wonderful to hear just a little bit about your motivation behind writing Hunting Party and a bit of your writing process as well.
I remember that just before writing this novel, I was on a literary tour with a very famous French author, male author, and he was there was a long queue just in front of his table, and with many women who were very happy to meet him and have a signature on their book. And in front of my table, there was no one. And I could have felt sad or angry, but it was the contrary. I was curious about what was happening because I had read the guy's book and I thought it was crap. And I thought, if you write that crap and you have so many people in front of your table, then anything I write will work. It's a strange logic, I must admit. But But strangely enough, it gave me the idea of writing. I thought, well, write just anything you like and you'll see what happens. So when I came back, I was on the train and I had this idea. But at first, I was baffled because I don't know anything about hunting. I don't have any hunter in my family. It's completely foreign to me. And for instance, I didn't even know how you call the rifle that you use when you go hunting. I didn't know anything about the dogs that you use, what kind of animals you kill. But I don't know why. It's just maybe in the end, there was a little bit anger in me because why rifles? Why hunting? But anyway, I had this idea that I wanted to write about hunters and hunting. But because I didn't know a thing about it, I thought my character has to be as naive as I am. And then the other thing was that I could not identify myself with the hunters, where it was very difficult for me. But I knew that I could identify myself very easily with the prey. So that's how the rabbit became one of the main characters with Tristan. And as you mentioned before, Jordan, I've written many books for children. So having a character who's not a human being that speaks is completely normal to me. I've had penguins speaking, whales speaking. It's completely ordinary to me. So in this book, and it's not the first time actually that a rabbit talks, because Lewis Carroll has done it before me. He was not the only one, but so that's how the book was born: hunting, hunters, and the prey.
That's a fantastic story, especially with your experience with that male writer. I think once you reach a certain point, you're just like, oh, okay, you know what? I'll just do whatever I want and don't worry too much about the results. But like you mentioned, you've also written children's books. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what that was like and how, if any, how does that any of that experience factor into how you approach writing a novel?
Writing for children has been a very important thing in my life and still is. Some writers start by writing children's books and then they stop once they've written the first or the second novel for adults. I never stopped because whenever I had something that was important for me to say or something, a very deep or serious subject that I wanted to tackle, I would never turn to literature for adults. I always chose to write a book for children. And the reason why is because children are very keen on questions. They love asking questions and they love questions and they're not too crazy about answers. I don't know if you've had this experience before, but sometimes you're in a conversation with a child and the child goes, "Why are the trees green?" And you start to explain something, but then they won't listen to the answer and say, "But then why does the sun shine? And where does it go when it stops shining?" And things like that. And they don't really care for the answer. They like questions. And my experience of grown-up people is that they love answers. And when you want to address a serious issue, answers are not the right angle. They just don't work. So whenever I want to address a serious issue, I always write a book for children. And then sometimes it infuses in my writing for adults. And also it used to be two different parts of my writing life. And more they merge together, and I don't make that much difference between one and the other. For instance, I never try I never wonder, oh, will children understand what I'm writing? Or should I make this sentence simpler for them to understand? I think that not understanding is part of the experience of reading. And actually, I found out that children are much more tolerant to not understanding than adults. For instance, I've had conversations with adults saying to me, "Oh, there was a word that I didn't know in your book and I had to look it up in the dictionary." as if it was a problem. And I never had this with children because they're used to not understanding, and they understand, they know that it's not, if they skip a word, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, that was a beautiful answer. And I find that the simplicity and the innocence that comes with children and a child's perspective is really what makes some parts of writing really valuable. So it's great to hear how that translates into your writing. So yeah, I think it would be great now if we can move into reading an excerpt that you both have prepared. So Agnes, I assume you'll be reading in the novel's original French, and then you'll alternate between the same excerpts, Christiana, in English translation.
La maison est plongée dans le silence. C'est le couvre-feu de 8 heures du soir. Tristan ignore où se trouve la chambre d'Astre. Il sait qu'elle va dormir ici cette nuit. Il peut presque le sentir, dans sa peau, sa gorge, la paume de ses mains. À cause d'une qualité particulière de désœuvrement, un ennui, une lassitude qui s'empare de certaines zones de son corps. Il reprend son livre là où il l'avait abandonné, à la première page, l'infranchissable première page, qu'il dépasse cette fois sans effort, sans rien comprendre de plus, voguant à la surface des phrases, animé d'une colère dont il ne sait que faire, cuisses serrées dans son lit ridicule, esquif pitoyable. Il lit, tourne les pages, avance comme on rame, en produisant un effort mécanique, l'œil absent, l'oreille tendue, guettant les bruits de pas, les grincements de porte, l'eau qui coule d'un robinet, et, beaucoup plus sourd, presque imperceptible, imaginaire en fait, le tomber d'un édredon sur la peau bistre d'un corps éclos. Il se distrait de sa lecture jusqu'à l'écœurement. Pourtant, sans le secours de la vue et de l'ouïe, absorbées qu'elles sont par de plus urgentes missions, quelque chose en lui, une partie enfantine ou au contraire vieille et sage, accepte la lecture, s'en imprègne, en profite, s'y perd, s'en éprend. Il se reconnaît dans le bonhomme, ce capitaine Macware, qui ne comprend rien à rien, imperturbable à cause de sa lenteur, à cause de sa bêtise, mais surtout à cause d'autre chose de beaucoup plus secret et compliqué, un élément caché que lui seul Tristan pense discerner. Macware a toujours tort et toujours raison dans le même temps. Quand il dit à Jukes, son second, ce lien qui lui fait défaut, où devrait-il se trouver, au-dedans ou au-dehors de lui? Ses yeux se ferment sur cette question, sur le roulis inquiétant qui berce trop fort le Nan Shan, ce navire. Mais en anglais, on dit « la navire », et c'est tellement plus joli, tellement plus noble, se dit Tristan, conquis langue à lui d'or, lovée dans sa mâchoire inférieure. Une main glisse au creux de son ventre, suivant la pente de sa maigreur, de l'os pointu qui saille aux entrailles vulnérables qui reposent. Une main, une langue, et bientôt une autre main qui s'affaire, qui s'affole, beaucoup plus agitée, beaucoup plus nerveuse que la première. La deuxième main est un écureuil, le corps de Tristan un tronc. L'écureuil se démène, grimpe, redescend, creuse, se blottit, décampe. Les mains de Tristan dorment encore, battoir gauche et ignare. Les mains de Tristan ne savent pas ce qu'elles ratent. Elles appartiennent encore, malgré leur taille, malgré l'instinct qui les précipite, souvent vers son aine, à l'enfance. Elles seront les dernières à se laisser contaminer, empoisonner, enivrer. Des genoux inconnus et des cuisses impossibles, tant elles sont charnues, tant elles sont lisses et rondes, se substituent aux siens. Tristan devient la navire. La houle le fait basculer du masculin au féminin. Une bave inconnue, une mouille intégrale enduit sa peau, le noie, l'engloutit. Ses doigts frôlent le drap, remontent le coton déjà froissé d'une chemise de nuit, soulèvent un jupon, un flot de jupons imaginaires, écume blanche, écume mousseuse et moite. Sa langue se réveille, appelée au secours par ses mains. Lèche ici, suce là. Tout l'équipage est sur le pont, luttant contre les vagues déchaînées, arrimant, souquant, affalant. Tout se soulève pour mieux replonger dans le profond, l'humide, la mer qui ne connaît plus ni haut, ni bas, ni dessous, ni dessus. Tristan grogne et combat l'hydre aux multiples têtes, aux tentacules innombrables. Ses poings martèlent et s'enfouissent, ses doigts se séparent et creusent et saisissent. On le mord, il mord. On le supplie, il supplie. On l'écartèle, il lâche, il consent. On le domine, il résiste. Ne va pas crier, ne pas crier, ne pas crier, pourvu que ça s'arrête, pourvu que ça ne s'arrête jamais. Le rire de nouveau. Eh ben voilà, dit Astre de sa voix rauque à faire trembler les murs, une bonne chose de faite. Tristan veut lui caresser le visage comme pour s'assurer que c'est bien elle, que c'est bien lui, qu'ils sont bien là, mais elle repousse vigoureusement sa main. Arrête, gronde-t-elle, j'ai horreur du sentimentalisme, ça me dégoûte. Vous êtes vraiment des ringards dans cette famille. Quelle famille ? Se demande Tristan sans oser ouvrir la bouche. Ta mère, complètement ridicule. Même petite, j'avais pitié d'elle. Elle s'y croyait. Mon père l'appelait Amour. Enfin non, pas mon père, mon oncle, le préfet, quoi. Amour. C'est sûrement elle qui avait inventé ce surnom. Pour qui elle se prenait ? Une rebelle ? C'était quoi sa rébellion ? Coucher, se piquer, boire les trois ? Franchement, l'autodestruction est à portée de tous. Mourir du sida, en plus, tellement ringard. Tristan sent sa mâchoire se crisper, ses mains se tendre, les muscles de ses bras se contracter. « Du sida ? » murmure-t-il alors qu'il voudrait hurler à sa cousine, mais est-ce vraiment sa cousine, si c'est la fille du préfet, de se taire, alors qu'il voudrait l'étrangler, la gifler, lui crever les yeux. « Le sida, tu connais pas ? La maladie des drogués, des homosexuels, des putains comme ta mère ?» Tristan ne répond pas. « Bon, on le refait ? » demande-t-elle indifférente. Et ils le refont, comme elle dit, à l'envers, à l'endroit. C'est une leçon, un Kama Sutra express, un tour du monde en 80 minutes.
The house is immersed in silence. It's the 8 o'clock curfew. Tristan doesn't know where Astra's room is. He knows she's going to sleep here tonight. He can almost feel her, on his skin, in his throat, on his palms, due to a particular feeling of idleness, a sense of boredom, a weariness that takes hold of certain areas of his body. He returns to his book, right where he left off on the first page, the insurmountable first page, which he goes beyond this time without effort, without understanding anything else, drifting on the surface of the sentences, compelled by an anger he doesn't know how to handle, his thighs clenched, as he lies on his ridiculous bed, a pitiful skiff. He reads, turns the pages, going forward as though rowing, producing a mechanical effort, his gaze absent, his ears straining, listening for the noise of footsteps, creaking doors, water running from a faucet, and much fainter, almost imperceptible, imaginary in fact, a duvet falling on the tawny skin of a body in blue. He distracts himself from reading to the point of nausea, yet without the help of his sight and hearing, absorbed as they are by the most urgent missions, something in him, something childish, or on the contrary, something old and wise, accepts the reading, soaks it up, thrives on it, gets lost in it, becomes enamored with it. He recognizes himself in Captain McWhirr, this man who doesn't understand anything at all, unshakable because of his slowness, because of his stupidity, but most of all because of something more secret and complicated, a hidden factor that Tristan feels he alone can detect. McWhirr is always wrong, and always right at the same time, when he says to Jukes, his second-in-command, "Was that you talking just now in the port alleyway with the third engineer? I can't understand what you find to talk about. 2 solid hours." Tristan feels a deep sense of recognition. He doesn't understand conversation either. He feels both full and empty, full of feelings and empty of words. He lacks a point of access, which he somehow pictures as a footbridge, but other times as the near invisible thread of a spider's web. Is this link supposed to stretch between thoughts and words, between him and others? Tristan doesn't know. Where can this missing link be found, inside or outside of himself? His eyes close on this question, on the disturbingly strong forces rocking the Nanshan, this ship, Le Navire in French. But in English you call a ship she or la navire, and it's so much prettier, so much nobler than the masculine version in French, Tristan says to himself, captivated by the language that is adopting him as much as he's adopting it. The ship that, thanks to the stubbornness of McWhirr, her idiot captain, is rushing right into the typhoon. A light being turned off wakes him up for 1 second. Someone has slipped into his room. Someone has closed his book and set it on the nightstand. Someone has pressed the little black button at the base of the light bulb. Someone who wants the best for him, who's taking care of him, who's watching over him.
so he quickly sinks into a deeper, rapid sleep, inhaled as if through a siphon by the absence of conscience, the absence of light, the absence of self. He is still sleeping with belligerence and passion when a hand places itself on his hip bone. A crystal laugh as light as pollen opens up a passage in his dream. The hand on his iliac bone is the wave against the ship's side, her side, this hermaphrodite vessel, masculine or feminine, as it passes from one native tongue to the other. A real tongue slips into his mouth, between his lips, which are wide open. It's a sturdy tongue, long and willful, which Tristan thinks is his, but no, his own tongue is asleep, curled up in his lower jaw. A hand slides under the hollow of his stomach, following the slope of his skinny torso, the pointed bones springing up from the vulnerable resting loins. A hand, a tongue, and soon another hand busying himself in a frenzy, much more agitated, much more nervous than the first. The second hand is a squirrel, Tristan's body a trunk. The squirrel scampers about, climbs up, climbs down, digs around, nestles, scurries away. Tristan's hands are still sleeping. Clumsy, ignorant paws. Tristan's hands don't know what they're missing. They still belong, despite their size, despite the instinct propelling them toward his groin, to childhood. They are the last to be contaminated, poisoned, intoxicated. Strange knees and incredible thighs, so fleshy, so smooth and round, substitute themselves for his. Tristan becomes la navire. The swell makes him swing from masculine to feminine. A strange slime, a complete wetness, covers his skin, drowns him, swallows him up. His fingers brush the sheet, pull up the already wrinkled cotton of a nightshirt, lift up an underskirt, a wave of imaginary underskirts, white foam, frothy and clammy. His tongue wakes up, called in by his hands for reinforcement. Lick here, suck there. The whole crew is on deck, battling against the unrelenting waves, fastening, rowing, hauling. They all come up in order to dive further into the deep, the wet, the sea that no longer knows high or low, over or under. Tristan groans and fights the hydra with its multiple heads and innumerable tentacles, his fists pounding and plowing, his fingers separating and digging in and grabbing on. He's bitten. He bites. He's pleaded with. He pleads. He's torn apart. He gives way. He consents. Don't scream. Don't scream. Don't scream. As long as this stops, as long as this never stops. That laugh again. There you go, says Astra in her husky voice that makes the walls shudder. A job well done. Tristan wants to stroke her face, as if to assure himself it's really her. It's really him. They're really here. But she pushes his hand away forcefully. Stop, she scolds. I can't stand sentimentalism. It's disgusting. You and your family are such losers. What family? Tristan wonders, without daring to open his mouth. Like your mother. Completely ridiculous. Even when I was little, I felt sorry for her. She was so full of herself. My father called her Love. Wait, no, not my father. It was my uncle, the prefect. Love! She's probably the one who invented that nickname. Who did she think she was? A rebel? What was her rebellion? Sleeping around? Shooting up? Drinking? All three? Frankly, they all pretty much lead to self-destruction. But dying from AIDS on top of everything else. Such a loser. Tristan feels his jaw tense up, his fists clench, his arm muscles contract. From AIDS, he murmurs, even though he wants to scream at his cousin. But is she really his cousin if she's the prefect's niece? To make her shut up, even though he'd like to strangle her, slap her, gouge her eyes out. Don't you know about AIDS? The disease for junkies, gays, and sluts like your mother? Tristan doesn't answer. Well, want to do it again? She asks, indifferent. And so they do it again. Anyway, she says, upside down, right side up. It's a lesson, an express Kama Sutra, a trip around the world in 80 minutes.
All right, thank you both so much for your reading. That was a really beautiful passage. So yeah, we've just heard a French excerpt from the novel Hunting Party from author Agnès Desart, and then a translated English passage from translator Christiana Hills. So yeah, Agnès, could you please tell us just a little bit about the passage that you both just read?
It's a bit after the middle of the book, and it's one of the memories that come back to Tristan's conscience at a moment in the hunting party, which is a dramatic moment because I've mentioned an overflowing river and a flood. And at one point, the earth collapses and
Tristan and one of the hunters fall into like, it's like a grotto or something, and they're trapped together. And Tristan has memories of his past coming back to him. And so there's this scene with his cousin. He's at this moment, he's a teenager, and he lives in England, and he's learning English. So that's why there's this thing with le, la navire, the ship that is a she in English and a he in French, because it's a new language to him, and he discovers all the differences with his native tongue. And I chose the scene because I thought that Christiana's rendering of it in English was amazing, not only because she has handled very delicately and beautifully the issues of the masculine and feminine, which are not the same in English and in French, and but also because of the rhythm that she's managed to keep, and because the rhythm is very important in this passage. I could have chosen the beginning of the book, for instance, when it's the rabbit speaking, but I thought that it was important because we're lucky enough to have the translator with us to show how beautifully the work has been done here.
Absolutely, and I really agree that just the impressiveness of the translation really came across in that passage. Now, Christiana, now that we've moved on to the subject of translation, did you want to share a little bit about your initial reaction to this book and also your translation process as well?
Yes, thank you so much, Agnes. Yeah, so I was doing a master's in translation at NYU, and we had a translation workshop course, and every week we would have a passage to translate, and there were five of us in the program, and it was all French. So we would have a passage to take home and translate and bring back, and then we would workshop it. And one week, the beginning of this book was actually the passage, because we were focusing on contemporary literature, and our professor, who was French, had chosen this. And I've actually never asked her about how she found it, why she chose it. But yeah, I just fell in love with the voice immediately. And I bought the book. I wanted to keep reading it. And then for that degree, the thesis project was translating a good portion of a novel. This was a very easy choice to make, that I already loved it. And yeah, I really wanted to translate it.
Definitely. And it's a really beautiful book as well. Further, was there anything about this novel or its subject matter that particularly appealed to you or inspired you, whether before you found it, while you were translating, or after you finished?
Definitely. As we read in the passage, there's this discussion of English and French, because Tristan actually, he has flashbacks from his childhood and he goes to England. So it's funny, because then I was translating it into English and it was the other side of that. And I guess as a translator, you're bringing two cultures together. And so it was cool how in the book you have this confrontation of cultures and this person who's in between them, trying to navigate them and looking for connections. And it just spoke so well to the experience of translation, I thought. And I'd also never read anything like it in terms of genre, the fact that you have this talking rabbit and you're not quite sure how it's happening and they're having these philosophical conversations. I loved it.
Definitely. And I can totally see the irony as a translator there as well. But that sort of perfectly moves me on into my next question to Agnes about the way the novel uses the abstract and the surreal to convey a message. And I find that oftentimes it's more effective to convey a message metaphysically rather than in overt concrete language, just like your message about writing children's novels. So how did you personally use the surreal and abstract while writing Hunting Party? And what role did it play both narratively and more holistically in illustrating themes and subtext?
Thank you for this question. I didn't know before starting to write that the surreal would invite itself within the novel. But it appeared, in fact, very soon as the rabbit started to talk. And the reason why the rabbit started to talk is because, as I said before, I could identify myself with the prey, but not with the hunter. And I thought, how am I going to deal with this? And I have to add that most of the time, when I have an idea for a novel, it surprises me. It's never the idea that I would have picked if I had a choice. They just invade me, come over me, and it's as if I had no control over them. It's the idea that decide. I'm not the master, I'm the servant. And so when this story about hunting came to me, it came as a catastrophe, because I thought, how am I going to write about this? Why, please, another idea, please. But it just would not stop. The idea stayed here. And it's only when I thought, oh, but in a hunting party, there are the hunters and there as a prey, that it all became clear to me that I could use this angle. And so I thought, you've been writing for children for so many years. And I don't know how it is in the United States, but in France, writing for children is not the coolest thing that a writer can do. It's like when you say, you know, imagine you're at a dinner party and the person next to you asks, so what do you do? And you say, I write. Oh, what do you write? I write children's books. Oh, okay. And they turn to the other person because they don't want to talk to you because it's not, I don't know. It's not sexy. It's not cool. It's not. In France, it's like this. So I was writing for children as if it was my secret life, because you don't want to talk about it. But I loved it, and I thought it was very precious. And I thought, oh, but it's going to help me this time. The fact that I'm an experienced person in having animals talking and being main characters in books, it's going to help me a lot here. Because I can have this character and it's not a problem for me because I know how a rabbit thinks. I know how a rabbit talks. So that's how the surreal came into the novel. But I have to add that it was not the first time that the surreal was part of one of my novels. When I wrote my second novel for adults, I had I thought it was a main character, woman, wonderful woman I loved. And suddenly, I was not expecting it, she died. It can be surprising to hear an author say that it was a surprise that the character dies, but I was not prepared. And it's the same with my ideas. They come to me and there's nothing I can do to stop them. The characters are just like that. They choose what they want to do. And if they die, they want to die, they just die on me. And so she died on me, and I was so furious, and I was missing her so much because she died at, I don't know, like page 40. And I was missing her so much that I thought, it's a book. It's not real life. She can come back, and she'll be a ghost. And so I had her come back as a ghost. And I remember my publisher saying to me when I handed back the manuscript, well, it's beautiful. I like the story, but, you know, there's a problem. The ghosts, they don't exist. You cannot have a ghost in a novel. And I said, what do you mean they don't exist? Of course they exist. And he thought I was crazy. And I said to him, don't tell me it has never happened to you that you hop on a bus and suddenly you see a little old woman with a silly handbag and a strange hat. And you think, oh, it's my grandmother, because she looks like your grandmother. But although you know that your grandmother died 10 years ago, but something makes you think that she's still alive, because in the corner of your eye, you've seen shadow or someone that makes you think about this person. So I say, this is a ghost. They exist. They are with us, around us all the time. So he said, okay, let's have the ghost. And it's funny, because after that, when the book was published, it was a big success, and I won a big prize for it. And I kept receiving letters from readers, and they were all writing, oh, and this ghost is just the same with my aunt or my grandmother. She comes back to me. And, you know, so to me, it's just surreal. It's natural. It comes naturally. Maybe because my grandmother was a witch. She was a real witch. She did witchcraft. And I've always lived with the feeling that magic was just around the corner. There's nothing more ordinary to me than magic.
That's wonderful and quite an interesting and fascinating story as well. And I think that you really perfectly captured the freedom that comes with writing, especially with using the surreal. There's a certain essence to it that's almost like lucid dreaming, just that freedom and that imagination. So similarly, Christiana, while translating, did you ever have moments? Were you related to or felt challenged or inspired by the surreal moments in the text? And did it in some way influence your own personal philosophy as well?
Well, Agnes, you used a phrase a few minutes ago, like the text is the master and you're the servant to it. And when you're translating, you feel that too, because I had fallen in love with this text and was kind of, you're translating it and go into this trance and they're like swept away with the characters and the story. And something, especially with this novel, with all the different characters and the different voices, I found when translating, like in the dialogue, really wanting to embody the differences in each of those characters. You find yourself speaking in a way that you wouldn't normally speak. Like, I'm not someone who swears really at all. And then you have the hunters that Tristan goes with swearing all over the place and drinking. And so, yeah, you really have to get into the text and leave yourself behind and embody it.
Yeah, as a reader, you already absorb so much of the text while reading and after you've finished, but I can't imagine how much that text becomes a part of you when you're that intimately connected to it as a translator.
Well, another thing to add, so I had mentioned I did this for my master's, but then it was quite a while before it actually got published because I sent it out to publishers, but I was this young translator. I had just graduated. I didn't know anybody. No one was interested in it just because I didn't know the right people there. I don't know, publishing. When it finally, someone fell in love with it like I did, I had to go back and edit it again after not looking at it for a few years. And it was like going back to see a friend who I hadn't seen in a long time.
Oh, that's really sweet. Yeah, because you had so much time with it. You really had a bond with it. Yeah. So yeah, before we go, I want to ask you both if you'd like to share any literary or academic projects that you're working on the moment or anything that you have going on currently that's lined up in the future. So Agnes, could we start with you?
Yes, I will mention two translations because as you've said, I also work as a translator. So I've just finished translating Cynthia Ozick's new book, which is called Antiques in English and Antiquité in French. And she's a very dear author to me. She's one of the best, I think. And so it was an honor to translate her again. And another book I've just translated, and it appears at the same time in England and in the States and in France. It's a book by international lawyer Philippe Sands, and it's called The Last Colony, La Dernière Colonie en français. And it's about the Chagos Islands. And it's a beautiful book.
Wonderful. Really excited to see those in the future. And Christiana, do you have anything that we could look forward to seeing in the future from you?
Yes, I just spent pretty much the whole summer translating this 500-page crime thriller. Something very different from this book about Cédric Banel's The French Spy. And it has this really complex plot with tracking down terrorists in Afghanistan, and these Japanese girls get kidnapped and there's a French spy trying to figure it all out. And so Agnes, not knowing anything about hunting, I have did all this research about like weapons used in Afghanistan and how poppies are cultivated. And it's one of the things I love about translation, that it takes you to these really unexpected places, and I'm researching things that I never would have learned about normally.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Writing and translating can take you on these really deep adventures and rabbit holes. So that's very interesting to hear about. So yeah, I really look forward to seeing both of your projects in the future. And thank you both so much for your time. It was really great having you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan.
This has been a conversation with French author and children's writer Agnes Desoss and translator Christiana Hills, focusing on the novel Hunting Party, published by Unnamed Press.
Women in Translation is an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. This series is executive produced by Traffica Europe Radio. Please sign up at our website to stay informed about upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.